can rot, I've done my back in, so I need to sit down. Playing tennis, I should have. Not very political assassin, I know. Right. Can you hear me alright?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's put it in a more comfortable place. Right, I think that's about it. Still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. My book was a book about the history of terrorism. It was actually a book about the first subtitle of the one that was part was called How Terrorism Transformed the Modern World. And my interest in that book was to look at the way that different societies imagine terrorism, the way they respond to it, the way governments use it quite often and manipulate it, and also the way terrorism in common looks to those who supposedly practice it. What do they look for? Why do they do it? What happens? And so on and so forth. And so a very important period for me were the last decades of the 19th century. In my book, I argue that this was a period in which the template of modern terrorism was basically established. The assassination of a tyrant has always been one of the more morally respectable forms of homicide, at least in certain circles. There can be no such thing as fellowship with tyrants. Nothing but a bitter feud is possible. And it is not repugnant by nature to despoil, if you can, those whom it is a virtue to kill. That was Cicero writing about that a long time ago. So tyrannicide has often been imbued with a special aura of tragic heroism. It even has a kind of halo about it. The assassin of a tyrant is always, or nearly or always aspires to be, David versus Goliath. In striking down a tyrant, he or she strikes a blow for liberty and justice, even if they die in the process. But actually killing a tyrant is not necessarily in itself a radical gesture. It might be or it might not be. But what I argue in my book is that in the last decades of the 19th century, a new concept of political assassination began to emerge on the world stage when sectors of the European anarchist, European American anarchist movement became fixated by a strategy of violence that was known as propaganda of the deed. From about the late 1870s through to World War I, six kings and heads of state were assassinated on both sides of the Atlantic by anarchist individuals and or organizations with some form of anarchist ideology. These victims included a number of illustrious corpses. The Russian Tsar Alexander II, the President of France, the King of Italy, and the US President McKinley. The same period was punctuated by numerous failed attempts, and also by the new use of dynamite as a revolutionary weapon. Sometimes it was imagined by anarchists as a kind of revolutionary super weapon, and it often had lethal consequences. All this was a real historical innovation. It was, in many ways, the world's first international terrorist emergency. To late 19th century bourgeois society, it was a period in which a new kind of monster entered history. The anarchist bomber with smoking bomb and glittering eyes intent on the destruction of everything. But it was also a period in which political assassination acquired different kind of heroism. And that's what I want to talk about tonight, that heroic ideal of the political assassin in that period. And I want to concentrate on one of the lesser known episodes, the failed attempt by the Russian anarchist Alexander Berkman to kill the American industrialist Henry Clay Frick. It was a strange episode that produced no casualties. It contains elements of farce as well as pathos. It contains many of the essential ingredients of propaganda of the deed and the concept of the heroic assassin that came with it. It's also an incident that reveals the limitations and the flaws in that strategy. And it's also, last but not least, one of the few cases in history in which the would-be perpetrator of a political assassination has written about his actions and motives in some detail. So before I discuss this particular episode, I want to make a few general observations about the broader historical context in which this act took place and the ideas that made it possible. The essence of propaganda of the deed was the idea that assassinations of high-profile representatives of the state could transmit a symbolic political message to various audiences that would ultimately paved the way for a wider revolutionary confrontation. Such assassinations were partly intended to inspire the anarchist movement itself and the working classes by demonstrating that the state and its institutions were not invulnerable or invincible. They were also intended to weaken the state politically, by showing that even its most powerful representatives could not escape the long arm of revolutionary justice. This strategy was practiced in various countries and with varying degrees of coherence across international borders in the decades leading up to World War I. To governments, police and the press, propagandists of the deed and anarchists in general, whether violent or not, were considered psychotic nihilists who were beyond any understanding. They were plague carriers, mad dogs, wild men who were put down. The Italian criminologist Cesare Lombroso believed that anarchists were evolutionary throwbacks who could be recognized by certain physical features, such as their long ears and their prominent jaws. Governments and police forces wasted a lot of time in the belief that a single organization was behind all these acts of anarchist violence. They sometimes invented them for their own purposes, but they couldn't find these conspiracies. Anarchist assassinations and assassination attempts were often used as pretext for mass arrests, official crackdowns, emergency laws used against the left in general, so plus sa chance. But the whole point of propaganda by deed was it didn't need an international organization behind it. It was a form of what's been called since leaderless resistance. It was available to anyone with the will or the means to put it into practice. Propaganda of the deed emerged in the aftermath of the Paris Commune, when the anarchist movement and the left in general was subject to widespread repression across Europe. So to some extent, it was a product of necessity. In the absence of revolutionary crowds and mass movements, assassinations carried out by small groups and individuals would demonstrate that resistance was possible. That was the theory. Propaganda of the deed was also a product of the world it was attempting to overthrow. Its actions were aimed at a wider constituency, real and imagined, that was now available through the spread of railways, shipping networks, telephone and telegraph, the rise of literacy, spread of mass circulation and newspapers. So propagandists of the deed knew that their statements, as they were called, would be transmitted to an international audience quite quickly. These connections also made it logistically possible for assassins to reach their victims even across international borders. Despite the use of dynamite, assassination was still a fairly low-tech business. Bombs usually needed to be thrown, not planted. The favored weapon was still the pistol and the knife. Industrial civilization also created a common arena in which assassinations were carried out against a wider background of class conflict that was unfolding simultaneously in various countries. Not only assassinations, this was a period of huge disparities in wealth and power, in which the working classes lacked political representation and were often subject to violence and repression when they tried to achieve it. An episode like the Haymarket bombing in Chicago in 1986, when the four anarchists were hanged on dubious evidence, became an international cause célèbre across the world, for the left anyway. Such incidents were seen as part of a wider international drama, and the propagandists of the deed saw their own actions in the same way. This meant that an action carried out by the state, for example, was often followed by a reaction that sometimes crossed international borders. King Umberto I of Italy was killed by an Italian-American anarchist named Giovanni Bresci in retaliation for the bread riots in Milan in 1898, in which 80 protesters were killed and hundreds wounded. The Spanish Prime Minister Canovas was shot dead by an Italian who travelled from London for the purpose, because his government had responded to a bomb attack in Barcelona in 1896 by arresting and torturing some 400 suspects in the Montjuic fortress. The French President Carnot was stabbed to death because he refused to commute the execution of anarchist Auguste Vaillant, who had previously thrown a bomb at the French Chamber of Deputies. When the French anarchist Emile Henry was tried and sentenced to death for throwing a bomb at the Paris Café, he listed a string of crimes carried out against anarchists and workers in various countries as his justification. To propagandists of the deed, the message contained in these assassinations wasn't restricted to the act of killing itself. Their perpetrators generally made little attempt to escape, and they expected to die themselves. The trials and court appearances that followed their arrest were a crucial part of the propaganda that followed the deed. It was an opportunity to deliver defiant speeches that would explain and justify what had been done and propagate the anarchist idea. Anarchist assassins were expected to show a study of contempt for the judicial machinery of the bourgeois state and indifference to their own deaths. In their willingness to sacrifice themselves, they hope to demonstrate the nobility of the anarchist idea and transform themselves, as well as their victims, into symbols of the wider political struggle that was taking place. This was the heroic ideal of the revolutionary assassin, and many people tried to live up to it. And all this brings us to the case of Alexander Berkman. Berkman was a Russian anarchist from a middle-class Jewish family with radical connections. His uncle was Mark Nathanson, the founder of the populist Tchaikovsky Circle, some of whose members later went on to assassinate Tsar Alexander II. Berkman emigrated to the United States in 1888, where he met and fell in love with another recently arrived young Russian anarchist named Emma Goldman. Goldman was then the lover of the firebrand German anarchist Johann Most, who was famous, among other things, as the author of a do-it-yourself bomb manual called Revolutionary War Science. And he had previously got into a lot of trouble with various governments over the years for his verbal advocacy of bombings and assassinations. Goldman left Most for Berkman and began an emotional and political relationship that would last throughout their lives. Both of them were strongly influenced by the revolutionary struggle against Tsarist autocracy. And in the summer of 1892, they were running an ice cream parlor in Worcester, Massachusetts, with the aim of saving up enough money to return to Russia. When the attention of the United States public was drawn to an abrasive industrial conflict in the steel magnate Andrew Carnegie's huge Homestead steel mills in Pittsburgh, between the Carnegie Steel Company and the Amalgamated Union of Iron and Steel Workers. Under the Carnegie Company's chairman of the board, Henry Clay Frick, the company was attempting to enforce a 22% to 60% pay cut on the Homestead workers and de-unionize the plant. The epitome of the robber baron capitalist, Frick was a self-made man who had become a millionaire by the time he was 30, and he was absolutely determined to bring in non-union workers into the Homestead factory. When both union and non-union workers refused to accept his conditions and went on strike, Frick locked out the workforce and erected a 3-mile fence around the Homestead plant. When the striking workers surrounded the mill to stop him bringing in scab labor, Frick evicted their families from their homes. Berkman and Goldman followed these events from their ice cream parlor. When Berkman heard about the evictions, he experienced a moment of revolutionary epiphany. As he later recalled, "I could no longer remain indifferent. The moment was urgent. The toilers of Homestead had defied the oppressor. They were awakening. But again, the steel workers were only blindly rebellious. The vision of anarchism alone could imbue discontent with conscious revolutionary purpose. It alone could lend wings to the aspirations of labor. The dissemination of our ideas among the proletariat at Homestead would illumine a great struggle, help to clarify the issues, and point the way to complete ultimate emancipation." Neither then, nor at any other time, does Berkman appear to have addressed the question of whether his actions would further or hinder the concrete and specific industrial struggle in which the workers of Homestead were engaged. On the one hand, Berkman is moved by an act of oppression so that he can no longer remain indifferent, but he also recognizes an opportunity to bring the utopian promise of complete emancipation to the blindly rebellious workers. So urgent was his calling that he and Goldman decided to abandon their return to Russia and began to prepare a propaganda unit to circulate among the striking workers in Pittsburgh. But before they had a chance to deliver it, the dispute at Homestead turned violent. On July the 6th, Frick brought in 300 armed Pinkerton detectives by river barge in an attempt to break the workers' blockade. The result was a pitched gun battle in which 7 strikers and 3 Pinkerton men were killed. Dozens more were wounded before the detectives were expelled from the plant and the state militia called in to restore order. Berkman and Goldman both decided that the situation was now ripe for an atom attack, a political assassination. As Goldman later remembered in her autobiography, "The whole country was aroused. Everybody was considering Frick the perpetrator of a cold-blooded murder. A blow aimed at Frick would re-echo in the poorest hovel, would call the attention of the whole world to the real cause behind the Homestead struggle. It would also strike terror in the enemy's ranks and make them realize that the proletariat of America had its avengers." The original plan was for Berkman to carry out the assassination alone, using a bomb and a timing device. After justifying his action in court, he would then kill himself rather than allow himself to be hanged. The two revolutionaries began to prepare for the attack, using their limited savings to buy bomb materials. The bookish Berkman knew nothing about chemistry or bomb making, but he tried to construct a device from none other than Johann Most's Revolutionary War Science, using that as a textbook. At night he worked away with his chemicals and dynamite in the house of a New York family where they were staying. Not surprisingly, Goldman was worried that he might blow up the whole building, taking the sleeping children and even the tenants in the building with them. Later she asked herself, what if anything should go wrong? But then did not the end justify the means? Our end was the sacred cause of the oppressed and exploited people. It was for them that we were going to give our lives. What if a few should have to perish? The many would be made free and could live in beauty and in comfort. Yes, the end in this case justified the means. Whether or not the family or the tenants felt the same way is not recorded. But when Berkman went to Staten Island to try out his bomb, it failed to explode. So the plan was now changed. Berkman would go to Pittsburgh himself and shoot Frick. First, he needed to buy a pistol and a new suit that would enable him to gain access to Frick's office. Goldman would stay behind in New York to help raise the necessary funds and live on to explain the meaning of his act to the world. After a last dinner with their hosts, the two anarchists went to the railway station and said goodbye for what they both believed would be the last time. The sequence of events that followed was vividly recalled many years later by Berkman in his prison memoirs of an anarchist. Writing in the first person and the present tense, Berkman recreates the train ride to Pittsburgh. He alternates descriptions of the dark satanic mills of the industrial Northeast with lyrical descriptions of the Arcadian landscape of rural America, which remind him of his formative years in Russia. He remembers his expulsion from school for writing a blasphemous essay, his quarrels with his mother, and her death from illness in his arms. But most of all, he recalls the heroic populist revolutionaries of his native land. Those men and women, the adored mysterious ones of my youth, who left wealthy homes and high station to go to the people. Berkman pays tribute to the Russian revolutionary, to his Russian revolutionary roots by calling himself Rakhmatev, as his nom de guerre, Rakhmatev being the revolutionary hero of the leftist novelist Chernyshevsky's What Is to Be Done. Berkman describes himself as a terrorist by conviction, an instrument for furthering the cause of humanity. He rejects his fictional hero's moral scruples regarding political homicide. He argues that society is a patient, sick constitutionally and functionally. Surgical treatment is often imperative. The removal of a tyrant is not merely justifiable, it is the highest duty of every true revolutionist. Human life is indeed sacred and inviolate, but the killing of a tyrant, of an enemy of the people, is in no way to be considered as the taking of a life. True, the cause often calls upon the revolutionist to commit an unpleasant act, but it is the test of the true revolutionist, nay more, his pride, to sacrifice all merely human feeling at the call of the people's cause. This is the ideal of a new revolutionary hero with dirty hands, who carries out the vile work of history to create a better world. Berkman's heroic assassin is no longer the giant killer who strikes a blow against the tyrant, but he is a noble and moral figure because he does what is ignoble and immoral in order to destroy a criminal society. He rises above what is merely human and suppresses his own humanity in order to make a more human world. To Berkman, the unpleasant act he is about to perform is always justified by the thought of the beautiful, simple people, so noble in spite of centuries of brutalizing suffering. This sentimentalized and very Russian image of the people is matched by contempt for society as it actually is, and also for himself. It's only through killing Frick and dying in the process that the revolutionary Berkman can lift his life out of the ordinary morass of humanity and achieve true spiritual greatness. What could be higher in life than to be a true revolutionist, he asked himself. It is to be a man, a complete man, a being who has neither personal interest nor desires above the necessities of the cause, one who has emancipated himself from being merely human and has risen above that, even to the height of conviction which excludes all doubt or regret. Once again, at no point in his reconstruction of his journey does Berkman appear to ask himself whether the workers of the Homestead plant require his intervention. On arriving in Pittsburgh, Berman stays with some anxious comrades before buying a pistol and suit with money from Goldman, who is meanwhile living a Russian melodrama of her own. The day after Berman's initial departure, Goldman decided to work as a prostitute in order to raise money to buy Berman his suit and gun, taking their inspiration from the character of Sonia in Crime and Punishment. But our only client was an elderly gentleman who took her to a nearby bar and told her to abandon prostitution and gave her $10 as an incentive. And that $10 helped Berman get his suit and gun. As far as we know, some of the details are a little bit blurred at that point. And on July the 23rd, Berman gained entry to Frick's office in Homestead by pretending to be a journalist looking for an interview. On being told that Frick was busy, Berman pushed his way into the office. At last, the propagandist of the deed finds himself face to face with his quarry, Henry Clay Frick, the capitalist Caesar. For an instant, the sunlight streaming through the windows dazzled him. I discern two men at the further end of the long table. "Frick," I begin. The look of terror on his face strikes me speechless. It is the dread of the conscious presence of death. "He understands," it flashes through my mind. With a quick motion, I draw the revolver. As I raise the weapon, I see Frick clutch with both hands the arm of the chair and attempt to rise. I aim at his head. Perhaps he wears armor, I reflect. With a look of horror, he quickly averts his face as I pull the trigger. There is a flash, and the high-ceiling room reverberates, as with the booming of cannon. Frick drops to his knees, and Berman is about to deliver the coup de grace when another man in the office suddenly throws himself upon him. Berman manages to free himself and fires another shot at Frick. He pulls the trigger a third time, but the gun fails to go off, and now other men are holding him back, including a carpenter who hits him on the head with a wooden mallet. The stunned Berman falls beneath the melee of bodies, reaching for the dagger in his pocket. Somehow he extricates himself and crawls towards Frick, stabbing repeatedly at his legs. But there are too many people holding him back. Frick then orders his staff not to shoot his attacker, saying, "Leave him to the law, but let me see his face." As Berman faces the wounded Frick, the heroic fantasy suddenly melts away. An officer pulls my head back by the hair, and my eyes meet Frick's. He stands in front of me, supported by several men. His face is ashen grey. The black beard is streaked with red, and blood is oozing from his neck. For an instant, a strange feeling, as of shame, comes over me. But the next moment, I am filled with anger at the sentiment so unworthy of a revolutionist. Berman was led away to the police station, where the police pulled a dynamite cartridge that he managed to conceal in his mouth to stop him blowing himself up. When Goldman learned of his arrest, she refused to believe that ordinary working men had prevented him from carrying out an act that was intended on their behalf. There was a strange coda to this, because Johann Most, her former lover and former verbal advocate of propaganda by deed, denounced Berman and called him a coward and even called him inept. And so Goldman went to a public meeting where Johann Most was speaking, and she had a bullwhip concealed on her dress, and she flogged him on stage in front of his audience. Meanwhile, Berman's attempt provoked another outbreak of moral panic from the authorities and the popular press, which variously described him as a frenzied maniac, a crack-brained and unbalanced crank, and a monster. The New York Times accused anarchists and socialists of breeding possible assassins in a class that hardly knows what honest labor means. Goldman was tracked down to New York by one newspaper and depicted as a monstrous queen of anarchy surrounded by swarthy, beer-drinking foreign fanatics in the beginning of her subsequent demonization by the American press. As far as the Homestead strike was concerned, Berman's attentat failed to re-echo in the poorest hovel. The Steelworkers Union sent Frick a message wishing him a rapid recovery, and Frick was back at work within a week. The only worker known to have understood the intended message was a state militiaman who praised the man who shot Frick and was court-martialed as a result. In November, Frick won his dispute when the union called off its strike and accepted his conditions. No union organization was allowed in the Homestead Mills for another 40 years. Bourbon's failed assassination was not the only reason for his defeat, but it clearly didn't help, and there's no reason to believe it would have been any more effective if he succeeded. Bourbon was sentenced to 21 years in prison, even though the standard sentence for attempted murder under Pennsylvania law was 7 years. Initially, he was so crushed that he considered suicide, but eventually served 14 years in his sentence. During that time, his attitudes towards political assassination became more ambivalent. When King Umberto of Italy was shot by Giovanni Bresci in 1900, Bourbon approved of the killing in a letter to Emma Goldman, but he also raised the question of whether the individual in certain cases is of more direct and immediate consequence than humanity. The same doubts reoccurred in other letters to Goldman. In 1901, President McKinley was assassinated by a neurotic loner named Leon Czolgosz, who had attended one of Goldman's lectures. And so the high priestess of anarchy was blamed by the US press once again for encouraging him. When Goldman was interviewed about the assassination, she expressed sympathy for both Czolgosz and McKinley, suggesting that both of them were victims of the same social tragedy. Bourbon agreed with her, but he also questioned whether the assassination was motivated by social or individual necessity, and he asked whether such acts really illumine the social horizon or merely confuse minds with the succeeding darkness. By this time, many leading anarchists were asking the same question, including some of those who had previously approved of propaganda of the deed, such as Kropotkin and Malatesta. As assassinations and bombings were followed by, invariably, by repression and violence, many anarchists concluded that propaganda of the deed had done more harm than good to the anarchist cause. Not only had the working classes remained largely unmoved and uninspired by the assassinations carried out on their behalf, but attacks and assassinations in many countries had marginalized the anarchist movement and often brought relentless persecution down on anarchists who had nothing to do with violence. In the years leading up to and after World War I, bombs and bullets and heroic assassinations increasingly gave way to revolutionary syndicalism with far more constructive results. Bourbon emerged from prison with his faith in anarchism still intact, devoting himself to writing and political agitation. Though he never engaged in violence again, he and Goldman were continually harassed and persecuted by the American police. In 1919, both of them were arrested and eventually deported to Russia during the mass roundup of foreign anarchists and socialists known as the Palmer Raids. That same year, Henry Clay Frick died, leaving a fortune worth $145 million. When Bourbon was asked his response, he replied that Frick had been deported by God. I'm glad he left the country before me. In 1936, worn out by ill health and poverty, fearful of becoming dependent, Bourbon shot himself in Nice, only a few weeks before the outbreak of the Spanish Civil War and the great anarchist uprising against Franco. But the idea of the heroic assassination that he tried to realize can still be seen in many other political conflicts, often in far bloodier forms than Bourbon and his contemporaries would have approved of. We might criticize Bourbon for his naivety, his short-sightedness, even his arrogance, in imposing his narcissistic fantasy of the revolutionary assassin on a constituency that had not asked for it. It is worth remembering this. Bourbon spent 14 years of his life in prison for attempted murder. Frick, the man who sent 300 armed mercenaries to the Homestead plant, was never punished or penalized in any way whatsoever for the deaths that resulted from his actions. No one was punished for the shootings of 9 unarmed workers at the village of Pouniers in France in 1891. The general whose soldiers killed 80 workers in Milan in 1898 was commended for his actions by King Umberto. These episodes were also part of the heyday of propaganda of the deed, but the societies in which they took place rarely reacted to them with the same outrage and horror that they showed towards the anarchist assassins. To kill in the name of the state was considered possibly tragic, but somehow natural, logical, and unavoidable. To kill the representatives of the state or the individuals that sanctioned such events was pathological, evil, and monstrous. It was like that then, and in many ways it still is. And as long as that discrepancy persists, there will always be men and women who seek their own kind of justice.